Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Science Facts and Fallacies, episode 209. My name is Cameron English. I'm your host. He's Kevin Fulta, your friendly neighborhood geneticist. Kevin, what's going on? It's been an exciting week from what I hear.
Well, just a lot on the plate. You know, we've been really working on getting a lot going at work, a lot going at home. Just everything's just completely crazy, which is good, the way it should be. Oh, and that rooster in the background reminds me that there's some people who find the pastoral scene in the background to be distracting and problematic, and for that we apologize. I should have my office back to normal pretty soon. So once we get that assembled, then we're good. But I still have people visiting and, visiting. When does a visit become living here? I have unanticipated roommates from abroad that should be here for a little while longer. So I'll get my office back. So tolerate the chickens, think about, think of them as a happy addition to a more pastoral podcast.
Yeah. See, the Russians had to go and invade a neighboring country, and it screws up everything for everybody, including us trying to do our podcast.
So. It's just one of the many reverberations, yes.
Yeah, it's Putin's rooster sounds. I don't know what to tell you. That's just the way it goes. So we'll power through. Apologies if you find that distracting. There's a whole archive of 200-plus episodes, so go listen to those chicken-free episodes just for you. And let's do these two stories, Kevin. We're changing up the format a little bit. It's been a crazy week, so we're going to focus in just on two things. So first up, keto and low-carb, high-fat diets linked to heart disease in new study. And secondly and finally this week, economic degrowth or, quote, green growth, which climate change strategy makes the most sense? Okay, Kevin, first up, what's going on here? I've been on a low-carb diet for a while. Am I about to keel over?
No, probably not. But this really goes back to, this is written by Karma Hassan and Sandy Lamott at CNN. And what this was another reference to something we've talked about before on the podcast, is this English BioLife trial, right? This study that's been going on for a long time. BioLife, I can't remember what this is.
Biobank.
So the biobank study. And the biobank study is this cohort that started years ago that's being followed as they go forward, comparing things like diet and disease and ailments and many other aspects of health and wellness. And they start looking at specific aspects of this in different ways to look for associations, and there's the key word, between different variables in these groups. And so the strengths of this is that it's a long-term study that's been following a very diverse cohort of folks within the UK. The downside is that these are still associations. So it's a link that, the weenie word is linked, right? We'd be calling this out if it was something else as well, that it's just showing that these two things happen at the same time. And maybe there's something there, maybe there's not. So what the question was they looked at the folks within this cohort who were in keto and low-carb, high-fat diets. And they started to look at the incidence of cardiac events. And what they showed was that there were, when in people where 45% of the calories were coming from fat and a little bit from carbohydrates, they were able to show that there were significant deviations in the low density lipoprotein, the LDL, or the bad cholesterol, right? And so this was one part of it. The other one was that there were differences in a compound called apolipoprotein B. And this is an excellent predictor of heart disease. So what they basically showed was that when you looked at these folks who were in the study for at least around 12 years, and you adjust all their risk factors, which always kind of a little bit of a red flag there. What they show is that people have twice as high a risk of cardiac events, mostly atherosclerosis, or I shouldn't say that, not atherosclerosis with plaques, or not plaques, that's atherosclerosis with blockages. That could lead to things like heart attack, stroke, that kind of thing. So that was the major outcome of this particular study.
You know, when we talk about weasel words like link and association, I always think back to this comparison that I heard many years ago. It was that in high crime neighborhoods, people call the police a lot. So if you're following one of these study designs, you would say, well, just stop calling the police because, you know, then you won't have so much crime, right? You have the association all mixed up. So that's, I think, important to keep in mind. I just had a few, and these are typical. I've said these a billion times, but it's self-reported in terms of diet. So you don't know if people are telling the truth or not. Chances are many of them aren't because they've done studies of these studies. And what you find is that people lie about what they eat, what they drink, whether or not they go to church, whether or not they do some other, you know, beneficial social behavior, what have you. So I don't know why these studies keep getting done, Kevin. We're giving people, you know, NIHs, they're giving people our money, hundreds of thousands of dollars at a shot to run Excel spreadsheets, basically. And then there's a press release, and then Sandy Lamott writes up this story. I don't know how many of these stories she's written in her career, but it's got to be in the hundreds at this point. So I don't know really know what we're doing. We have good clinical trial data from studies that they actually look at low fat versus low carb diets. They do about the same in terms of weight loss and you know, metabolic health. They actually quoted Christopher Gardner in this article, who is a researcher at the Stanford Medicine. And he's done clinical trials. The most famous one is the Diet Fits trial from 2018. So yeah, I don't think this adds to the literature, and it hasn't been published anywhere yet. It was presented at a conference. So, you know, we can't even say very much, but I'm just inherently skeptical of this entire field at this point.
Yeah, I agree 100%, because for me, I think about this, the reason they're looking into this particular cohort is these folks are dieting and they're trying to manage their weight using a method that works for them. And we always talk about that on the podcast. You know, what the best diet or the best exercise plan that works for you is the one that you're likely to stay with. And so folks who are in keto diet or low carbohydrate, it is apparently working for them to the point where they're sticking with it. You know, no one goes on one of these things, which cannot necessarily be easy. And then sees their weight increasing, you know, and their body fat changing for the negative, and then says, okay, well, I'm going to stick it out with this particular diet because it seems like this one does work for a lot of people. And I know that I put on weight easy when I put on when I eat more refined sugar, more carbohydrates. So it seems to be me that you have to be extremely careful when looking at data from studies like this one.
Yeah. Yeah. And I believe you mentioned it, that 25% of their calories came from carbohydrate. So if you're trying to get into ketosis, that's not going to do it. So that's another thing. I haven't seen the paper because it hasn't been published, but you know, you're not really studying ketosis if you're looking at people who are getting that much of their diet from carbohydrate, because you're just not going to get into ketosis at that point. It's kind of like saying, I want to find out about binge drinking, so I'm going to study people who have, you know, 4 drinks a week. And based on that, it's like, you can't do it. So anyways, I mean, it is what it is. So, you know, eat what works, like Kevin said. That's the best way to go about it. Okay. So let's move on, Kevin. Degrowth versus green growth. What is the story about?
Well, this was by Edgar Hurtwich of Science Norway, and really delineates the difference between how do you anticipate or how do you expect the emerging economies and developing world to be able to grow, what makes the most sense in terms of a plan for energy. And it's based upon the idea that the current industrialized nations benefited from cheap fuel for many years. You have lots of fossil fuel you can mine from the earth and burn at your discretion to get to fuel economic prosperity. And the argument says, or the article says, this is all based on a study that his group has done that was published in a journal called One Earth, And the idea of how do you uncouple economic growth from fossil fuel? And can you? And what they show is that these two things really do go hand in hand, and that for every 1% of economic growth, you have 1% more carbon emission. And they seem to be very parallel. These are proportional relationships that occur. And so when developing nations are really starting to pick up speed, you can't help but contribute to carbon emissions. So the idea of economic degrowth, as they put it, can you look at countries actually, do you want to take industrialized countries and expect them to go a little bit backwards in their economic growth by adopting sustainable measures? Or is there a plan where you actually can have both? And that's really the basic take home. Is there a better order to starting with clean energy and then running the economic machine to grow an economy?
Yeah, I have trouble with these kind of stories. Not to be such a negative Nancy this week. I'm sorry for doing this in advance, but it's always, and again, there's a parallel, Kevin, with the people who talk about, you know, the blessings of organic farming. It's always people that have a full fridge and a grocery store right down the street that want everyone on the other side of the world to, you know, use these really ancient, frankly, growing methods. And it's the sort of same thing here where it's like, you know, I'm in this country that prospered because of fossil fuels. But now that I've done that, I'm going to teach you how to not do that because, you know, the planet or climate change or what have you. And I find that a little convenient. Like, what's your, that saying you have that, you know, farming is really easy when your plow is a pencil. Is that how that goes?
Yeah, that was Dwight Eisenhower.
Oh, okay. We'll see. You're a good company then if Dwight Eisenhower said that. But you get what I'm saying, right? I mean, sure. You know, right now we are dependent upon fossil fuel provided electricity. My computer here is made of plastic, which is, you know, made derived from fossil fuels. So I find the baseline of the argument a little unconvincing in that, you know, I'm proof of how this thing works, but don't do it. And I could see why India or China or some other nation that's probably just a little bit behind them would go, no, I'm gonna burn fossil fuel until my population has a standard of living that's at least comparable to the West. You know, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I see your point, and I get that. I think that does make some sense. I think the difference is that when you're talking about, you know, doing farming the way we say to do it over here, you're actually stepping backwards in the way that you're doing it. Okay, you're going backwards to make less efficient farming per acre. We know that already. Land use increases. I mean, any organic farmer will tell you it takes more labor and more time and more dollars to do it, more inputs. But this has a unique opportunity here in that if there was a way that there was investment from the industrialized world in emerging economies to decarbonize, and maybe they could be, so rather than foisting this upon them as, you know, this is the way that you should do it according to us, look at us, you know, we did it the other way, really looking at it as an opportunity. Are there ways that your economy can first set up on nuclear or solar, tidal, whatever, geothermal? Is there a way that you can start out that way? Because we didn't have the same knowledge that we have back when carbon was being mined from the earth for development of the industrialized world. And with that, previous knowledge, plus a lot of understanding of how to use nuclear correctly and incorrectly, it really is an opportunity for the developing world to seize these new strategies to become leaders in this area. And especially countries that are, I wouldn't say at the bottom edge, not in necessarily emerging economies, but look at countries like India and China, which in a way are leaders in the world in a lot of ways. Can they really start to implement these technologies on a broader scale? And China's done that. The Three Gorges Dam powers about a third of the country's electricity needs. So they have found ways to do these massive government projects, which do invest in renewable resources. Or I don't know if that's renewable. I guess it is. It's a non-carbon resource. It's renewable as long as the water keeps flowing. But it's really just kind of, the whole article is just kind of a, as you say, it's a little bit condescending in that, well, we did it this way, you should do it the other way. But it really does say that this is an opportunity for emerging economies to maybe take on alternative strategies.
Maybe. And again, I could be just reading into it, but it was just the last sentence that says, basing development on coal and oil and changing industrial structure afterward is harmful to the environment and economically wasteful and politically challenging. It is wiser to change the sequence, clean up first and then invest in development. You know, okay, if you say so, I guess, because the other aspect of this is that economic development gives you the resources to invest in an EPA or in some sort of a technology that's going to reduce your carbon output, you know? So any country can pass a law that says, you know, our CO2 emissions must be at this level forever and ever. Amen. And it's just a piece of paper. If you don't have the resources and the willpower to do it, it doesn't matter. So, I mean, it seems like nuclear is viable if you can get the political support to push it, but from country to country, I don't know how practical that is. I mean, here we have some nuclear power, but it's been relegated to obscurity because of all the rules we have. And then in terms of renewable energy sources, I mean, those have to be subsidized or they won't survive. So I don't know. I mean, maybe I can look into this more, but it just seems sort of like, you know, we could make this work in a model, but, you know, is this going to translate, I suppose, is the biggest question.
I think it fits well with the way I always talk about climate and the way I think about carbon use, is that you're not going to stop people from doing what they're doing. I think that the use of carbon is what it is. We're going to have too many people driving to work in the industrialized world. You're going to have emerging economies want to burn the fossil fuels because that's what's cheap and available and it works. What it's going to take to change that is not restrictions and not penalties and not the decarbonization, you know, laws. What it's going to take is innovation that allows us to leapfrog carbon and innovation that changes in the way solar storage, electricity storage, the way that we can improve nuclear power safety and regulation and disposal of its products. So those kinds of technologies will come. I think they will. I don't think it's going to be, you know, gut check time for everybody to shut up and, you know, stop using fossil fuels. I think it's going to be a time where we look at the opportunities in front of us by far outweigh the desire to use fossil fuels. So it's just a question of investing in technology and governments doing that. And I think that that's kind of what's happening. And well, that's actually the latest legislation out of Washington with the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, I went through that very skeptically and actually think one of its high points is the amount that it does invest in not just subsidies, but invest in creating changes, hardcore changes in renewable fuels and the use renewable fuel use and ability to adopt. So those things together look like maybe the right way to create the change.
Sure. One other thing that as we wrap up here, I want to add just to sort of reframe the discussion a little bit is that the weather has killed people forever. You know, extreme heat, extreme cold, those are deadly because you don't have shelter and you don't have the technologies that keep you warm or keep you cool or you know, allow you to grow food despite the elements. So let me see. This is a recent paper I looked at, but about a century ago, natural disasters, weather-related disasters, they killed more than 1 million people. And today it's somewhere between, depending on which estimate you look at, it's between 10 and 20,000 deaths per year. And the reason is that people have very practical tools like air conditioning or, you know, a roof over their head. And it's interesting, if you were to, like, in the middle of winter, you know, just go and spend the night outside without any of the things that keep you alive, you'd probably die, you know? So I don't know. It's sort of, when we think about this issue, we look at it as, you know, climate change is bad. It's going to kill lots of people if we don't do these specific things. And the whole other side of the equation is left out, namely that the weather already kills a lot of people. And you could prevent that with cheap energy. So anyways, we could go on all day, Kevin, but I think we said what we need to say.
Sounds good.
All right, everyone. That's going to do it for us this week. We're going to keep it short and sweet. We'll be back next week. Full three stories, and we'll make a bunch of ridiculous dad jokes like we always do. But follow us on social media in the meantime, at Kevin Folta on Twitter, and my writing is at ACSH.org. And follow Genetic Literacy Project. They're just at Genetic Literacy. Thank you so much, as always. See you next week for episode 210.